Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Okay, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're really getting into a landmark piece of work, The Dead Are Arising, Malcolm X, A Life. It's by Les Payne and Tamara Payne.
Yeah, this book won a Pulitzer, and it's built on, what, almost 30 years of deep investigative work. Our goal here is, well, it's to look beyond the icon, maybe even beyond the story Malcolm told himself in his autobiography. We want to find the actual person, Malcolm Little, and trace that incredible radical transformation he went through. It's truly one of the most powerful stories in American history.
It really is. And what makes this book so vital, I think, is that it's not just another biography. The Paynes call it a foundational corrective. They did incredible reporting, digging into the specifics, the raw details of his youth. And they make this compelling case. You really can't grasp Malcolm X, the leader, without first understanding the boy, Malcolm Little, how the trauma he endured quite logically shaped the man he became. So let's start right at the beginning. Omaha, 1925. Malcolm Little is born. His parents, Earl and Louise, they were already activists, weren't they? Followers of Marcus Garvey, preaching black pride, self-reliance.
Absolutely. Deeply committed to Garvey's UNIA. And this wasn't some quiet life. Their activism put them directly in the crosshairs.
Right. The family was under, constant threat from white supremacist groups.
Yeah.
The Black Legion, for instance.
Exactly. A really vicious group active back then. So his earliest memories are basically steeped in fear. Their house in Lansing was firebombed in 1929. Malcolm was only 4.
But the event that just shattered everything, that was his father Earl's death in 1931. Officially, it was ruled an accident, hit by a streetcar.
Which just defied logic for anyone who knew the situation. The family, the community, they all knew it was a lynching carried out by white supremacists.
And the aftermath was brutal, too. The loss wasn't just emotional.
No, it decimated them financially. The insurance company claimed it was suicide, refused to pay out. Louise, his mother, she fought incredibly hard to keep her 8 kids together. But the pressure, the poverty, the constant condescending scrutiny from welfare officials, it eventually led to her mental breakdown. She was institutionalized in 39.
And the family was just scattered, annihilated, really.
Yeah.
For Malcolm, watching this unfold, it drove home a terrible lesson, didn't it?
Yeah. That the system, the white world, seemed almost designed to destroy black families, black lives.
And that feeling, that experience, it leads us right into one of the key moments the Paynes highlight. Malcolm was smart, did well in school, even elected class president. He told his 8th grade English teacher, Mr. Ostrowski, that he wanted to be a lawyer.
And the teacher's response, just devastating. He told Malcolm that being a lawyer was no realistic goal for a nigger.
That casual dismissal, that sort of soft racism.
It was almost worse than overt violence in some ways. It was a betrayal from the very system he was trying to succeed in. And it basically confirmed all the harsh lessons his father's murder had taught him.
So he just drops any idea fitting in, right? Leaves school.
Completely. Abandons that path. Moves to Boston, then Harlem. And he becomes Detroit Red.
The hustler. The dealer. The burglar. It feels like a conscious rejection, a kind of nihilistic rebellion against the world that rejected him first.
It absolutely was. But Interestingly, this period on the streets sets the stage for his next massive transformation. He gets arrested for burglary, ends up in prison in 1946.
And that prison sentence becomes, paradoxically, his education.
His university, exactly. The Paynes point to two big influences there. An inmate named John Elton Bembry, known as Bimby, who was self-educated and really sparked Malcolm's intellectual curiosity and then Malcolm's own incredible drive. We all know the story of him copying the entire dictionary word by word.
Oh, sure.
Just imagine the discipline.
It's incredible. And it's during this time he converts to the Nation of Islam, the NOI.
Yes. And the NOI gives him this framework, this structure. It takes all that trauma, all that rage, and channels it into something focused. Religious belief and political action.
The change is immediate when he gets out on parole in 52. He drops Little, his slave name, takes the X, and his rise in the NOI is just meteoric.
Absolutely. He becomes Minister Malcolm X, easily the most dynamic speaker, the most visible national figure for the nation. He just got media how to use it.
And there's a specific incident that really cements his power and influence, right? The Hinton Johnson incident in 57.
Yeah, that was pivotal. An NOI member, Hinton Johnson, was badly beaten by NYPD officers. Malcolm organizes this demonstration outside the police station in Harlem. Hundreds of NOI members standing in discipline formation, utterly silent. It apparently completely unnerved the police. They actually gave in to Malcolm's demands regarding Johnson's medical care and legal access.
Wow. So that showed the NOI's discipline is power.
Yeah.
But it also announced Malcolm X on a national stage as this new kind of leader, a force to be reckoned with.
Undeniably. It wasn't just about sermons anymore. It was about organized power in the streets.
So he's got this organizational genius, this public profile. But the Paines argue his thinking, his philosophy, was also constantly shifting. It wasn't static. They identify like three distinct phases.
That's a really key insight from the book. Phase one is what most people associate with him early on, the NOI phase. Strict black nationalism, the idea of separation, the theology of the white man as the devil. The goal was building separate black institutions.
Right, the fiery speeches, the uncompromising stance. But the Paines dig deeper into his motivation, don't they? It wasn't just about hate.
No, they argue it stemmed from this deep, wounded love for his people, born out of that childhood trauma. The rage was fueled by that and by this relentless drive for truth. Remember his famous quote, "I'm for truth, no matter who tells it. I'm for justice, no matter who it's for or against."
And that very commitment to truth, ironically, is what pushes him out of the NOI and into the next phase.
Exactly. That leads to phase two, post-NOI pre-Mecca. After he's suspended from the nation, we'll get into why in a bit, his focus shifts dramatically. It becomes much more political, explicitly pan-Africanist. He founds the Organization of Afro-American Unity, the OAAU. Now he's framing the struggle not just as a domestic issue, but as part of a global fight against colonialism and white supremacy, connecting racism in the U.S. to the bigger world picture.
That shift to pan-Africanism, making it a global human rights issue. The Paines really emphasize how threatening that was. Why?
Because it took the struggle out of America's internal affairs narrative. It internationalized it. It aimed to put the U.S. on trial in the court of world opinion, accusing it of violating human rights, not just civil rights. That was a direct challenge to U.S. power and prestige, and also undermined the NOI's more contained religious framing.
Which leads directly to the final and perhaps most profound evolution.
The post-Mecca phase. After his pilgrimage, the Hajj, in 1964, he embraces Orthodox Sunni Islam. He takes the name El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. And critically, his whole view on race changes. He starts distinguishing between individual white people and the system of white supremacy. He famously writes about seeing Muslims of all colors, including white, praying together as equals.
He publicly renounces the idea that all white people are inherently evil.
Yes. His focus sharpens entirely onto systemic racism, political and economic power structures, and his goal becomes crystal clear. Take the case of U.S. racism against black people to the United Nations. Frame it as a human rights violation demanding international action.
It's such a journey. The Paines research makes that evolution so clear. Instead of just listing events, let's maybe zero in on three moments. Three core truths the book reveals as crucial for that transformation.
Good idea. The first, I'd say, is the failure of assimilation, crystallized by that eighth grade teacher. Mr. Ostrovsky's comment wasn't just hurtful. It confirmed for Malcolm that the system itself was rigged, that striving within it was maybe futile for black people. It validated his father's warnings, in a way.
It basically slams the door on one path and pushes him toward defiance.
Right. The second key truth or turning point has to be the necessity of betrayal. This hits hard in 1963, 1964. He discovers that his mentor, Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the NOI, had violated the nation's own strict moral codes, specifically regarding extramarital affairs.
That must have been earth-shattering for him. His faith was absolute.
Completely. It shattered his trust not just in the man, but in the organization he'd given his life to. It forced him out spiritually and intellectually. He had to stand on his own. His comment about JFK's assassination, the chickens coming home to roost line, that gave the NOI the public pretext to suspend him, but the break was deeper.
He chose truth over loyalty, even though it meant total isolation.
And immense danger. Which leads to the third pivotal moment, the shock of universalism. That's the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca in 64.
Seeing Muslims of all races together.
Exactly. White, black, brown, praying as equals. It completely dismantled his previous belief that whiteness itself equaled evil. He had to publicly confront and rearrange, as he put it, his entire worldview on race.
And that shift towards a more universal human rights perspective, ironically, made him even more dangerous, didn't it? To both the NOI and the U.S. government.
Absolutely. Because now he wasn't just a black Muslim separatist. He was building bridges, potentially uniting the U.S. civil rights struggle with global anti-colonial movements under a banner of universal human rights. That was a powerful, threatening synthesis.
The book really drives home the human cost of that growth, though.
Yeah.
That final year after leaving the nation.
Yeah.
The isolation must have been immense.
Oh, profound. The Paines detail the constant death threats, the FBI's intense COINTELPRO surveillance, the firebombing of his home just days before his assassination. He knew he was marked.
His courage wasn't about not being afraid, was it?
No, it was about speaking despite the fear, maybe even because of the urgency the danger created. He knew his time was short.
And what does that teach us, you know, listening today?
I think the big lesson is that real growth, real intellectual honesty, often requires you to abandon beliefs you once held fiercely. You have to be willing to change when the evidence changes, even if it's painful or makes you unpopular. Malcolm went from white man is the devil to seeing potential allies among all races in a fight against oppressive systems.
He showed that being consistent isn't always a virtue if it means ignoring the truth.
Exactly. Wisdom sometimes demands inconsistency with your past self.
And his ideas, especially from that later phase, they still feel incredibly relevant. The focus on systemic racism, connecting it to global power, arguing for human rights, not just civil rights.
Absolutely. You see the echoes so clearly in movements like Black Lives Matter today. That strategy of internationalizing the struggle, framing it as a human rights issue, that's very much building on the path Malcolm was forging in his final year. He provided a blueprint.
Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive, drawing from the Paines' incredible work, let's try to distill three core takeaways for you, the listener. First, an emotional insight. The architecture of rage. The driving force behind Malcolm X wasn't just hate. It was fundamentally a deep, wounded love for his people, stemming directly from the trauma he witnessed and experienced as a child, his famous rage. It was disciplined, strategic, a shield built around that profound love and sense of justice.
Second, an intellectual insight. The prison library. Malcolm X's transformation underscores the sheer power of knowledge. His greatest weapon, arguably, was his relentless pursuit of education, starting with copying that dictionary in prison. His journey proves that intellectual liberation is often the essential first step towards political liberation. Knowledge is power. And finally, a universal insight, the courage to revise. We all shape our own narratives. Malcolm's life, Little to Red, to X, to Shabazz, is this powerful testament to the fact that identity isn't fixed. It can be, and maybe must be, constantly reevaluated and courageously recreated in the search for greater truth and understanding.
The Paines really make you appreciate that his assassination tragically cut short his most developed, most potentially impactful phase. That final vision, more inclusive, internationalist, focused on human rights, it still offers so much, both inspiration and practical strategy, for anyone working towards justice today.
That willingness to evolve, to keep revising right up to the end, maybe that was the most revolutionary thing about him. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.